Welcome back to the 9-8 Podcast, the home of progressive and underground music right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and this week we have a very special episode. This week we have Doug and Mitch from the Australian prog metal band Hamina to talk about their new album, Night Echoes. This episode covers the writing process, opening for Haken, and online music streaming. Enjoy! Okay, Doug and Mitch, welcome to the 9-8 Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Hoggy. Great to be here.
My pleasure. So, how did the band get started out and who influenced you to start making music?
Well, around 2008, 2009, I remember I was at uni at the time and listening to a hell of a lot of like power metal and progressive power metal, and I was kind of getting a little bit over that sound, so I was trying to look for people to make a bit more of an inventive band with. I think back then we were really aiming to have really novel stuff, no common like song structures and that kind of stuff, not much repeated sections. The band's kind of changed a lot since back then. We've probably homogenized the sound a little bit over the years, but definitely back in those early days it was all your standard ones, Dream Theater, Symphony X, Camelot, all those kind of bands. I'd say probably the same for you as well, Mitch. Mitch got involved like about 6 months after the initial idea of the band started up.
I was I came from a area of like being really into like Iron Maiden, the traditional kind of metal, but then as well discovered like the power metal stuff. I think my first song that I ever heard was a song by Camelot, which was off the Karma album, Across the Highlands. And I was like, what is this? This is amazing. And I actually remember there used to be a bookstore on the way home from school that had a pretty decent secondhand heavy metal section. So I would just go in like each Friday and just listen to a bunch of CDs. And from there, I discovered Halloween, Angra from Brazil, a whole bunch of others. I think Stradivarius as well was within that. And then just discovering those couple bands sort of just opened up a massive doorway of all the other bands that are out there and were around at that time, because this has gone probably 2003 to 2005, which is when I was in high school. And just bombarding myself with all this kind of music, and naturally this new influx of music that I'd never heard before sort of translated through to my songwriting. And then, Doug hit me up because I was actually trying to form a band on my own, but I couldn't really find any like-minded musicians that were sort of like on the same page, or sort of like, not to big note myself, but I couldn't find anyone that was capable of playing at my level as well. So then that's when Doug sort of hit me up, because I knew Doug through one of my schoolmates, and he said, yeah, I've got some material. And I said, yeah, I've got a bunch of material as well. Let's do it. And yeah, we've gone from there pretty much.
Yeah, fantastic. So how would you describe your music to a music fan who's never heard you before?
It's changed over the years, because like our first record, Synthetic, like for example, workmates and work people asking me what my band sounds like, and this was like around when Synthetic was released, I was saying like we kind of sound like 70s rock, like Pink Floyd, if you've heard of that. Oh yeah, I know Pink Floyd, yes. Oh yeah, those bands. So we kind of sound like that, but a bit heavier, but a bit more like 80s guitar solos. But then it's changed over the years.
We've made a big change from the second album onwards. Like, it's definitely become a lot more groove focused.
Yeah.
And the lush vocal harmonies has been, I guess, the big signature. And I guess there's been a bit more of an uplifting edge as well in the music over the last couple of albums. So I'd say it's like uplifting, extremely melodic, progressive metal.
With a big focus on vocals. With a lot of groove and like a huge focus on like vocal harmonies and just connecting with the listener rather than trying to impress the listener, if that makes sense, with too many chops, just trying to make stuff memorable and just, yeah.
Yeah, I reckon that's spot on.
I think that's a fairly natural progression for bands as well. You mentioned Dream Theater earlier. I always think of Rush as well. You think of the change between Hemispheres and Permanent Waves, for example, where it was all technical, long songs, let's see how complicated we can make the thing, into more, you know, the melody and everything sort of stood up more on its own rather than just being pure chops. So I think it's a pretty natural progression for a lot of bands.
I think it's pretty similar, yeah.
So
definitely, for me, I connect probably more that late 70s, early 80s Rush where they kind of did that transition as well. So, yeah, I can kind of see the parallel there.
Fair enough. I mean, prog is a four-letter word that gets tossed around a lot. And what does it mean to the band?
I think that being like a strict fan of prog is not really anything that the rest of us do in the band. Like Jess, for example, is not like, she's not super into the nitty-gritty old prog, at least, the 70s prog. You're not going to catch her listening to Gentle Giant or many King Crimson records. Probably the same goes for Mitch, I would say.
Yeah.
Nathan's more likely to go back to the old days, and I guess I am too, from playing in Anubis. I've got a lot of those 70s prog influences as well. But for us, I would just say we're just trying to make things that sound unique, and it's not saying like it's copying other people's styles. And to me, that's probably the more important thing about prog. Like, just, I don't really like the retrogressive kind of sound where you're just going back and copying the way people sound in the past.
That's pretty much it, because like when I write, like I discard so many ideas that come out of my head, because like I'll jam to a riff or a chord progression or write something into Guitar Pro or record it, and then I'll be like, I've heard this before. I mean, I don't want to be just emulating like what so many other people have done. And to me, like to my ears, it sounds standard if I'm going to do that. So I'll discard that and try and do something that my ears haven't heard before. And that's sort of like just a natural thing for me to do. I don't actually really even think about it. It's just like, if I don't like the way something's sounding, it's generally because I've already heard it before. So I'm just aiming for something different. And that just happens like in a natural way, if that even makes sense.
Different without being like super avant-garde and I guess abrasive to listen to. I don't think we're ever going to write that. We still want to be like melodic at the end of the day.
Like, so we might sound a lot like other bands, but we're not actively trying to sound like other bands. It's just a natural way of how we do things. And for me, I don't know about Doug, but for me, like Guitar Pro is a really good tool for me, because it allows me to write something a little bit beyond my ability, and then I can practice it more and then, you know, get better at those riffs or those leads. It's super good for writing solos. I'm all for improvisation and I love it. But I really like to structure my solo so it's going somewhere. So Guitar Pro is a good tool for me.
Fair enough. I was going to ask a question as well. When it comes to you, when you're writing instrumental passages in a song, do you improvise or are they more composed? So it still sounds like you've got a bit of both going on there.
I would say nearly all of it is very composed.
Yeah.
And even like through composition, I think that most people, you improvise to get there, right? You'll improvise something and you keep looping something over and over again. And as you improvise it more, you pick out the pieces of that you liked and that worked the most. And that ends up really becoming your composition.
We don't really jam.
Yeah.
It's more like sending files back and forth. Like Doug might like churn out a whole damn song and he's like, I need guitars for this. So then he'll send it to me and I'll just, you know, whatever word you want to use, whether it's writing, jamming, there's jamming there. You've got to sort of like just muck around with what you're playing to get to a particular point where you think, okay, I can see and I can hear where I'm trying to go with this. And then that's sort of like where I personally input my notes into that program. I'm actually new to the whole recording thing now, so maybe for the next album, the approach to writing may be a little bit different. Yeah. But for the past for the past, like, what, 15 years or so, composing in a program has been the way it's gone for me, and pretty much for Doug as well, really.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So tell me more about the writing process for the latest record, Night Echoes.
Okay. I guess we get a bit antsy with writing a lot of times. By the time an album comes out, we're usually starting to work on material for the next album, or we've got heaps of stuff banked up. So that kind of happened last time. And as soon as Venus was done, there's already some songs shaping up by that point in time that ended up on Night Echoes. So I think most of the time it would be fair to say that the music always gets written first before vocals or before lyrics, and even before the concepts and that kind of stuff. We might be thinking about that in the background, but yeah, it's usually trying to write music first for all of them. And this time we definitely had it in mind that we wanted to do a bit of a shorter album, aim for something that would fit on the standard vinyl length, and something a bit of a change from what we've done in the past, because we've always done these really long 70, 80 minute albums, and it's kind of nice to have a bit of a break from doing that. So we kind of had our mindset for having to write around 45 to 50 minutes of material. I think that Mitch and I probably write a bit differently, but most of the time you're obviously writing music first as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I know Doug can just like, because we, as I've said, we both use Guitar Pro, but the way Doug differs his writing to me is I think you just sort of like have the program open without any guitar and you just like sort of input stuff. Yeah. But whereas I'm very guitar orientated, like even with like keys and chords and stuff, like I hardly write without the guitar. And in terms of like Night Echoes, how your question was, we're writing stuff all the time in between. So by the time, you know, we get antsy for that next record, first things first is we just sort of like go through what ideas we might have, unless we're sort of just writing stuff for it anyway. So there's just a whole back catalogue of just ideas that we've got. So our next album's going to be pretty set as well.
Yeah, we got already like more than an abundance, more than enough material to make another album, with heaps of small ideas that are less structured, like on the side. But in terms of even structured stuff, we've got it now. I think in terms of songwriting, though, probably the big difference with between Mitch and I, Mitch, as he was saying, he holds the guitar and he's very guitar-driven. I think I'm very chord-driven with how I'm writing stuff. I'm always trying to find like a unique chord progression or a unique voicing about doing things. So it means we can work quite well in partnership. Because I might come up with more of the outline of a guitar bit, and I'll say, Mitch, you make it a bit more flashy, you add the guitar finesse to it. And I think that's always been a big element of our good songwriting partnership over the years. Jess as well wrote quite a bit of stuff with me on this album. We would just sit together and just write some riffs and that kind of thing, and then I would try and arrange the riffs. Or if there's a song where I'm like too close to it and I can't come up with a vocal melody, I'll just bring her in. I'll be like, sing the first thing, improvise the first melody you think of over this song. And I'll be like, okay, do it again. We might do it like 5 or 6 times. I'll record what she come up with, and that might end up informing like the whole vocal melody for a song. What we've done in the past, we were those really annoying guitarists that would write all the drum parts out for the drummers to try and play, which I think all drummers fucking hate it when we do that. Nathan included. So with Venus, we had been living with some of those songs for years before it came out. Some of them in there, like their primitive form, was around probably even from when our first album was being made.
Yeah.
So some of the songs, like the grooves, particular grooves in a song, it was so hard to unhear it when Nate started writing, like, albeit really, really good drum rhythms to stuff. We'd be like, nah, it just doesn't sound right, because we'd heard this same groove like 4 or 5 years beforehand.
There was some serious compromise on Doug and my behalf, because you know you just get used to the way something sounds, and then someone comes in to write something different. It was like you're changing up our baby in a way. But there's some, like in terms of Venus, there's some great examples of how we had like a drum beat and a drum passage, and then Nathan's changed it up. And at first it's like, oh, it just sounds so weird. But then like, it's just been absolutely great. I think a good example on Venus is Fantasy and Secret Safe, especially the verses of Secret Safe. the drums were much more sort of like halftime fill and
it was
sort
like Pink Floyd drumming almost. It was really, really laid back.
And then Nathan just throws in like the more of the thrash beat, which I kind of hated at the start. Yeah. But then when I heard it, I was like, yeah, that's actually pretty fucking cool, man. So, yeah.
I never really even remember what the old ones sound like now. I don't miss any of it at all.
Nah.
It's kind of like, we just accept it as it is now. But we did with Night Echoes. It was really hard to do from, I think, Mitch and my perspective, but we tried to write all the songs with no drums.
Yeah,
just so we were writing this, we were structuring it all out, had all these riffs there with no drums at all. I'd demo them all up with no drums, which is really weird to kind of feel where the grooves would be. But it left a blank slate for Nathan to be able to write all the drums that he wanted on it. And I think that made it a more cohesive effort as well. It's definitely a lot of writing from and a contribution from all four of us on this one. And I'm sure it will be that way moving forward now. There's nothing fun about just doing stuff all by yourself, like doing the solo project as a band. It's not enjoyable at all.
Yeah, I can imagine it being a bit painful trying to work that way. So the new record itself is a sort of a I don't know if you would describe it as a concept record, but I certainly think of it as a concept record, and I think it could lend itself to being played all the way through cover to cover live. Would you ever consider doing something like that?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's the aim. Annoyingly, the songs aren't necessarily structured for playing live in the best way, in the sense that they kind of change guitar tuning from song to song.
Yeah.
Whereas we could kind of structure it to make it easy to perform live in a different order. But definitely, I think we're going to play all the songs. And that definitely played into it a little bit this time, trying to write songs that were a bit easier to play live, maybe. It's probably just like a subconscious thing there. Some of them are still fucked to play. Flicker is a bit of a nightmare, to be honest, but we definitely want to play all of them live. And yeah, it is a concept album, maybe not as so much of a heavy-handed narrative kind of story, but it's definitely centered around a theme about a young boy trying to make his way through adolescence after not having like that father figure there in his life. And it's kind of throwing back to one of the earlier albums where there was a central male character who committed suicide. And this character here is actually the son of that guy. So it's kind of a replay of history told 20 or 30 years later. And it's more thematic kind of concept album rather than like each story, each song is like a part of the story that leads into the next one.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I don't know whether you think of it as a concept record, but it's because there's definitely two kinds of concept records. You've got something like Tommy or The Wall, for example, versus Dark Side of the Moon, where you've got story based versus themes and that sort of thing. So when it comes to writing lyrics, Doug, you wrote most of the lyrics on this record?
Yeah, I think that it just, because I'm writing the vocal melodies most of the time, it just naturally means that I end up writing the lyrics because they kind of go hand in hand. And that's the same this time. And I think because I'm the one who's gone crazy with all the concept stuff, it just happens to pan out that way. And Jess has helped out with some lyrics before over the last couple of albums. And then even back on Nebulae, Phil helped out with a song as well. But just, I know that's kind of the way we've worked. And it hasn't been that much of a challenge to me doing it like that. But if the other rest of the guys in the band wanted to write some lyrics and that kind of thing, I would not be against it as well. Just kind of hasn't really been the way we write stuff.
I mean, for me, I just sort of let you do your thing with the lyrics because, I mean, putting notes together for me, it's pretty easy, but putting words together, even though that I love, like I'm an outgoing kind of person, so putting those kind of words together is fine, but writing something as a, you know, for a listener to hear is not my forte, so just sort of like let Doug do it. And it's better that way because it's like, I know it sounds cheesy and corny and whatever, but I am a dead set hardcore fan of Doug's writing himself, like the lyrics and the song. I'm always keen to, like, when he tells me, oh, I've been working on this song, I'm just like, just give it to me. I want to hear it. So it's not like, oh yeah, cool, you wrote a song. I'm just like, nah, I want to hear this. I want to hear what he's come up with. So it's always just gives me like a fresh sort of vibe when, you know, new songs are coming around. So it's always an exciting time for me when new albums are coming, because it's always interesting to see what he comes up with and what new stuff I'm hearing.
Somewhere deep down in my heart, I still love you.
I wonder if anyone gets that reference. Or is that just a random thing?
I had to break the Dr. Phil tension. Yeah, thanks,
man. That was getting shit. But yeah, you know where I'm going. It's just Doug sort of just leads the charge on the lyrics. And the other three of us have not really, we'll just let him do his thing.
Fair enough. I'm always fascinated by how singers go about using their voice. Now, all four of you sing in the band. How is it decided who sings what on what song?
I guess it's dictated by our timbres, really.
Yeah. I think usually it's like because I've written the lyrics or whatever and I'm writing the harmonies as well, I guess you could say I'm the one who says who's singing what part, but sometimes it just if I'm writing a particular melody and it's in a certain range or it just it's natural who's going to sing the part, and I guess that's I'm doing more of the leads overall, so the main bulk of the melodies will be sung by me, but then I'd like to try and break up like a chorus here or a bridge here be sung by someone else to have that completely different sound. And we kind of know like each person's strengths with singing as well. Like if it's a higher part that doesn't really need that much power and it just needs to be more effortless, like it's going to be something that Jess will sing a harmony for. If it's like a really belted, high gritty stuff, that's going to be something that Mitch will do. And if it's some crazy like a high thing, that usually ends up me being those me being all the weird little girly parts. And then Nath kind of just fills in when we need that extra voice there. He doesn't sing live, but he kind of fills in that little bit of extra warmth on certain parts. And we did used to have like a lot of good vocals with our old keyboard player Phil back in the day as well. So just the different timbres of the voice kind of call for who's going to sing what. And I kind of like having the multiple lead vocalists as well in the songs. It kind of makes it a lot more fresh for me to listen to as well. And I don't think that many people do that. So it gives us a bit of a unique offering in that way too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely a strength of the band was when you have multiple people or three-part harmonies, especially. I'm a big Yes fan, and it was always really interesting to hear how the three-part harmonies worked. So I think it's definitely a strength of the band.
I learned it, I think, a lot from Dave and Anubis as well. He was one of the guys that was a big teacher of that stuff to me. Like when I first joined the band, it jumped out to me how good the like three-part and four-part vocal arrangements were, and it was not something I was really into before then. In the sense, I would have liked the sound of it, but I didn't really write for it and didn't do any of it at school or any of that kind of thing. So kind of just internalized what he had to offer and inserted that into the Hermina sound later on.
Okay. I thought we'd play one of the songs on the show right now. You mentioned earlier the song Flicker. That's definitely one of my favorites on the album. How did that song come about and why was it chosen as the last one on the album?
I think that Flicker came about probably one of the earliest of all the songs. Some parts of it I had written, well, I wanted to use for this funk kind of side project I was doing a while back, but it was definitely way too prog for that. Eventually ended up layering up with some more metal kind of guitars. It is a weird song in terms of structure. Like I listen to it now, I don't even know how I wrote a song with that such a strange structure like that. But having that really long synth passage at the end, which has the crazy vocal solo at the end there, it feels like that's a natural end to something. And I don't know where else you'd put that in the album, just purely from having that musical section there. You couldn't really put it in the middle of the album. It would be quite random. So it naturally kind of fits that part there. And it starts off heavy. It's nice to have that towards the end of the album, something that really lulls you out at the end, but it has some chunky, ballsy riffs in there as well. And lyrically, just kind of happened to have that that sense of getting over your grief, which was a big part of the themes behind the album. So it did slot in nicely there as the last song.
So we'll play that song right now. This is Flicker.
protectors, and fathers are providers, and family is the lifeblood. It's why we needed you, grieving, crying. We'll tell you to walk alone as you cross the Rubicon.
That was Flicker from the new album Night Echoes by Hermina. So I thought I would have a quick chat about Progfest and how that goes went for you. Now, Doug, you obviously had a tough job there pulling double duties, playing with Anubis
the double
first
trouble,
and then with Hermina. How did that day go for you guys?
It's pretty fun, actually. It was strange. It was like the the first gig we had done since the previous Progfest, actually, I think.
Yeah, we hadn't played a
gig in a year. In a
year, man.
Because we were doing all the writing, and I guess seems like we had a lot of downtime just to write this one 45-minute album. But as we were saying, we do bank up a lot of songs, so there's pretty much another 60 minutes of material ready to go. It was a great day. I love playing the Progfest. It's definitely got a much bigger following than what it used to have back in the day. Yeah, in the early days when you heard Progfest Sydney, it'd be like 100 people there, 150. Since Wild Thing has taken it over, they seem to have done some good stuff with it. And it's getting closer to that Melbourne vibe that we always kind of heard about. Even when Progfest was small in Sydney, you would hear about these 900-person, 1,000-person Melbourne Progfest shows, which we never had. So it seems like it's growing per year, and I think someone dropped out this year, so we got to fill in, so it was cool. We got to play 2 years in a row. I don't think they like bands normally doing that. Double Duty's fine. They're not very long set, so all good.
Just half an hour puppies.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a fun day. It was a good day, mate. Yeah.
It's one of the things about Progfest that kind of annoys me is that they probably try and cram a few too many bands in there, whereas I think it might have been better suited if bands had a longer set. Like I just got back from Night of the Prog, actually. And you think about beautiful. every band on the bill has guaranteed 90 minutes. Obviously the headliners get a bit more here and there, but I thought that was a much better way to do it, would have the band, especially for prog music as well, if you've got longer songs or whatever, it'd be better for them to have maybe a few less bands on the bill but have them play for longer.
I think a stock 45 minutes, like if we're talking about half an hour, 45, I reckon an extra 15 minutes, and as you said, especially for prog, it's like that's a good just default time, and then
it should be the minimum
if it's something else like Progfest. Get 45 minutes or an hour, and as you said, have less bands on. You know, you can do two shows a year, I don't know, whatever.
I would much prefer that, man. 30 minutes seems to be the standard, like, opening slot all the time, the standard kind of offering with a lot of gigs now, if you're not like a headliner. And you're just barely getting warmed up when you're playing that. It's a bit frustrating, you know, like all the effort that goes into the day just to be there for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Night at the Prog, when a Nervous play there, I think we played like 80 or 90 minutes as well, and that was a great amount of time. It gives like a new band a chance to reach out to some fans. No matter what time they arrive in the set, they're going to catch a big chunk of what you played. It's much more enjoyable as a fan as well to actually be hearing music for a bit instead of people just doing band changeover and that kind of thing. It's too many. I agree with you, man.
As a band as well, it gives you like, imagine if like every... How many bands do you reckon were at Progfest?
Must have been 20 or so.
Okay, so 20.
There was at least maybe 10 or 12 in each room. Yeah. I only went to the one in Sydney, so I can only speak for that one. But yeah, I think it was like 10 or 12 bands over the night in each room.
Imagine you had 12 bands, right? Now, my math is shit, so here we go. Like, imagine you had 12 bands and each band played for like an hour and 15 or 90 minutes. As a band, playing that long, it also gives you a chance to hone in your craft as a band. Because I always see practicing and playing as like a layering, a part of a layer. So like you're at home and you're learning a song, right? And then you learn that song and you get that song down as tight as you can, right? And then you come to the band rehearsals and you're all shit at it because you haven't played it together. Then you get to a point where you're really good at playing together, and then you go to play live and you're not as good playing it live as you are in band rehearsal because there's a whole bunch of other variables live that just make that happen. So playing longer gives you a chance to really like, who knows, after half an hour, maybe like the band's like, that's when you get in your nook and you're nutting shit out really good. Half an hour, I feel, just doesn't give enough for you to do it. And being prog as well, like we sort of try and space our shows out, being a niche sort of market. It's not something that we can do like playing every 2 weeks. I don't think as many people would come. But yeah, the point I'm trying to make is like longer sets. And you know, if we could play more frequently, you'd get really, really good really fast. It's just unfortunate that we don't get the opportunity to do those live shows for as long and as often.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing as well, purely as a fan, having you're listening to a band for an hour and a half, you do get a sense of, yes, I really like this band, or actually, no, I don't. And
yeah.
we quickly worked out that if we wanted to buy any merchandise from the bands, we needed to get up to the merch desk as quickly as possible, because otherwise we weren't going to be able to buy anything. Which is what you want for the band as well, because sure. you guys can sell more merch.
Yeah, 100%.
That festival's surprisingly good as a band, like to sell merch at.
Yeah,
they went crazy at Night of the Prog for the Noob stuff. We sold out of all of our merch there.
Yeah,
something to be said about the different generations of music fans as well, right, man? Like, cause that festival's got a lot of people 45 and over who seem to be like upper middle class, that have a bit of spare disposable income to buy music, and they're really supportive. Whereas you go to the more metal festivals, which Hamina is likely to play, we're a bit more of the entitled generation. We've stolen stuff on Napster our whole life. You know, we're not buying as much music. And this doesn't really apply to me, but, you know, like, people are more happy to get on the piss and get smashed than support the band they're there to see.
Yeah, I had some experiences with that on the last trip, you know, going to see The Who, and people were just, you know, getting more interested in just being there and getting drunk rather than actually watching the music, which is just, yeah. But you mentioned there actually about Napster and stuff. I see an interesting parallel between the way that things work now with Spotify and how you put out Anubis' first record. Do you agree? And what if anything is different?
I think back then there was a lot more of a focus on BitTorrents. Like, Torrent was a thing where people were getting music in that way rather than buying CDs, because people were happy with the digital medium. A lot of people were spending a lot of times using digital media players or sitting on their computer playing games, or just, you know, chilling out on the net listening to music. So digital is a good format for that, and I consume digital a lot now. But the idea of downloading music, I feel like that's less popular now. The streaming service kind of gives you the same kick for a small amount of money, or even no money and having annoying ads, which I can't deal with. So there has definitely been a big shift in the last like 10 years. I would say like music downloads feels like not that as popular at all now. And physical copies seem less popular as well now. So I think maybe we were smart to release the Anubis album that way back in the day.
Yeah, I don't think you could do it again that way now. I don't think that'd really, you just,
it wouldn't get much reach now.
You just put it on Spotify and let the Spotify algorithm sort it out. I mean, we sort of already touched on it a little bit, but how do you feel about the rise of Spotify and streaming, both as artists and as music fans?
You want to take any of that first? You want me to have a go?
It's like, I don't know. It's a tough question, because as a consumer, I think it's great.
So
it's
good.
The album's just there, and you can just like listen to it. I mean, like there's an Italian band called DGM, and I'm like a massive fan of theirs. And they released their album The Passage last year, and I was just waiting for it. And I was in a point where like, I pretty much didn't have any money, right? I had my Spotify account, but I didn't have money to like buy the album or anything like that. And it's just so cool, just to, when it got released, I could listen to the whole thing as many times as I wanted. So as a like consumer, it's pretty cool. As an artist, well, you don't make that much money from it, do you? So
yeah,
but it's also still good to just have it, and YouTube as well. Just have your shit there, just for your fans, just to have straight away.
I would say, I agree with pretty much everything Mitch was saying there. As a consumer, it's so good, man. It's so convenient. And unfortunately, I find I buy a lot less CDs now since having Spotify, because it's just so convenient. You pay like your $10 per month or whatever it is, for $12 a month for premium, and then you're sweet. You can listen to nearly anything. And stuff that really isn't on Spotify nowadays, I probably don't really bother to try and find it to listen to, which is a bit sad. As a artist, I guess, it puts you in that kind of compromising spot where, you know, you're being like a slack piece of shit and not buying anything either. And you're kind of making other bands not really get that much money. I kind of ignored Spotify for a long period of time, thinking like, oh, you know, you make your $0.007 per stream, whatever it is, and it's going to work out to be nothing, and just completely disregarded it. And this was before I was even using it as a consumer so much. And I realized then that somehow some of the songs from Venus started getting on these playlists, these progressive metal playlists. And they started a couple of them rocketed up pretty high. I remember seeing that Moonlight Bride had got to 100,000 streams on there. And I thought, well, this actually is, that's pretty impressive. Like it was, and I had no awareness of it at all. I started kind of taking a bit more notice of it then. And since then, a couple more of our tracks have got added to those like progressive metal, the curated playlists that are done by people who work at Spotify. And the streams have gotten into those kind of a couple hundred thousand stream range. And when your album's been out for a while, people aren't buying physical albums so much, but there's this constant stream of, say, like $100-$150 a month coming in from the streams for us at our kind of small size band, which is pretty good. Like that's enough to kind of, I guess, cover all your rehearsal costs, really, if you think about it. It's putting money into the band kitty so you can buy stuff that you need to when you make your next album. So it's not all bad. I think definitely from Spotify we see the most streaming royalties. And I'm glad it's there rather than it not being there.
Yeah. We've heard on the show from David Anderton of Chaos Divine that Spotify plays sometimes dictate who gets to open for big international acts in Australia, which I'm not sure how I feel about that. That's kind of an odd thing to be considering, I suppose. But you guys have opened for Haken. A lot of our listeners are wanting to know how to get on these opening slots when big bands come to Australia. How did you get the spot?
Okay. In terms of whether it's a thing that should be considered, I don't know. I think like it has some credence. If you have some streams there, it gives you an idea of how you're being seen on an international stage, at least. That it gives you some idea of an overall popularity online if there's some buzz about you. And I guess they have to use some metrics to determine whether they want to put you on a show, whether it be like your different social followers. Album sales is kind of hard to go by now, right? Because people are so lazy with buying that. So I guess it's kind of become the proxy way of seeing that your album sales. It's not the same, obviously, but in terms of how we've applied to do stuff, nothing really magical there with it. It's like if I see a band, I think that we have some kind of crossover with the sound, I contact the promoters and just say, hey, this is us. This is who we've played with before. This is what we're doing as a band. We've released 4 albums, whatever, now. Give them just like not too long of an email because no one wants to read anything there. Never send an email with like attachments that are going to clog up someone's inbox. It's just like put a link there so they can listen to the music within like one click. Don't make it hard for people at all to check out the music. Very clear, just friendly but professionally worded. And yeah, we don't get every single thing we apply for by any stretch of the imagination. It's like we have got some good supports over the years. I'm really, really like glad and proud of the ones we got. I think Haken was a really good one for us, and we feel pretty pretty blessed to get that one. But there's nothing really different to the normal approach. I mean, sometimes we've got them, they just come out of nowhere and approach us saying, do you want to play this support? But most times we have applied for them.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to be in it to win it, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that maybe once a band has gotten 1 or 2 opening slots, that then opens the door for them to become more prevalent, like an opener? I'm just thinking of like Voyager, for example, who seems to have opened for absolutely everybody. Mm. So once you've got yourself as a bit of a name for being someone who opens shows well, I guess, then that leads on to more opening slots, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think it definitely gets you a little bit more publicity and gives you a little bit more credibility as well. So when I hear of another band, like, I'm a big music supporter myself. I'm going to go to a lot of the gigs that are around. So if I've gone there and I've seen them open, I kind of think, oh, these guys are going somewhere. They got some buzz to them at the time. So I think the promoters would think the same way. And with these opening slots, it's nothing particularly generous in terms of what they pay you. You get paid, but it's a very small amount. Sometimes you have to cover your own lighting and your sound, and you barely break even on the what you get paid to what your expenses are. What they want it to be, they want opening bands who are going to be zero hassle for them. You go there, you turn up, you play, you don't cause them any problems or any headaches. They don't have to worry about you at all. You're just going to put on a show there. So I think that's one of the work ethics people need to kind of build. Be that reliable person that's not going to cause any problems. Not going to send them a billion emails asking for reconfirmation about all different kinds of stuff. You just get on with it and do it.
And I suppose as well, they're probably looking for a band that can possibly draw in an audience of their own, maybe, or an extra,
I think so. I think that definitely play into it, yeah.
Mm. So the last question I have for you is the one that I tend to ask artists at the end of every interview I do. If there was one song you were contractually obligated to play live at every gig for the rest of your career, which one would you pick?
I probably would play I would say.
I'm just trying to think. My strength is my baby. So
you want to be forced to play that every time?
I get fucking mad.
Love
at,
it.
At guitar, man. Just get my chops up big time. I's a good one because it covers a lot of like different ground in the song. So I'm just trying to think of For me, it would be Fantasy. I absolutely love that song, and it's so fun playing it. It's a really great song. So yeah, Fantasy. If I had to play a song every single gig, yeah, it would be that one. 100%.
Fair enough. Okay then, Doug, Mitch, thank you very much for joining us on the 9-8 podcast.
Thanks, bro. Cheers. Thanks, appreciate dude. It.
The 9-8 interview.
That about wraps it up for this week on the 9-8 podcast. If you'd like to hear more discussion about Hamina's new album, head over to their YouTube channel, link in the show notes, for an in-depth track-by-track review of the album. Hamina will be touring the east coast of Australia shortly, and their dates are as follows. Saturday, October 5 at the Baroque Room in Katoomba, November 15 at Crowbar in Sydney, November 22nd at Bendigo Hotel in Melbourne, and Saturday, November 30 in Dubbo. Tickets available through Oztic. Thank you for joining us here on the 9-8 podcast. My name is Alex Hogg. I'll see you next time.